Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll delve into the history of sundown towns in Illinois, known for discrimination against African Americans. But in many of those same communities, there have been recent protests for racial justice.
Individuals across Southern Illinois are definitely taking note that it is unusual and, to many people, inspiring to see, and mostly young folks, taking a stand against racism in many of these rural towns.
More on that ahead. With the nationwide focus on policing, what does that mean for school resource officers? And what's it like to be tested for COVID-19, a reporter finds out. That's some of what we have coming up on Statewide. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. This is Statewide. Coming up, the protests over police brutality and racial justice have some schools reconsidering school resource officers. We'll hear more about that. A lot of disappointment with graduation ceremonies canceled due to the pandemic, but it's been especially hard on those who are the first in their families to finish college. And what's it like to be tested for COVID-19? A reporter found out, and so will you. Those stories and more this hour. With the protests taking place since the death of George Floyd, we thought it would be a good time to listen back to an interview from last year that shows the ugly past of some Illinois communities and maybe some hope for change. Sundown towns are locations where it was understood African Americans should be out of the city limits by nightfall. They weren't welcomed a lot during the day either. There were many of them throughout Illinois. One of them was in Anna, in southern Illinois. Logan Jaffe of ProPublica wrote about the history of the town and what's happening today, and I spoke with her last fall. Logan, what made you decide to take on this story?
Years ago, maybe about 5 years ago, I had read a book about sundown towns, aptly titled Sundown Towns, and it was written by a man named James Lowen. He is from Decatur, Illinois, and actually, I believe that Anna, Illinois, is the first town mentioned in his book about sundown towns. And it actually starts in a similar way that I experienced in real life about 2 decades later after he wrote that book. And that's initially what got me curious about Anna in particular. And I think, you know, on another level, I've always been really interested in legends and myths and lore and the backstories for why things are named the way they are. When it's applied to something like ANNA, which is something that I heard that a lot of people know about, but also don't know about, that's the space that I was very interested in exploring and learning more.
And you write about your first conversation with somebody when you came to town, and this term ANNA, spelling of the town Anna, came up in that conversation.
It did. It was my first experience, my first time meeting somebody in Anna. Actually, I had gotten into town, you know, dropped my stuff off at the Super 8 Motel, and then I was just going to go and get some dinner. And my original plan was actually to start reporting the next day. I went to Main Street in Anna because I wanted to get some dinner, sat down at the bar of a restaurant there, and, you know, just got to talking to people around me. And I asked the person next to me after, you know, a couple minutes of conversation, I said, "Tell me about this town." And then the man replied, "Well, you know how this town is called Anna?" And at that moment, my heart sank a little, and I was thinking to myself, is he going to say this out loud right now? And then the next thing out of his mouth was, Anna stands for ain't no N-word allowed. And he said that word in full. I just sat there trying to take that in. I'm not entirely sure exactly how I responded right after that, but what shocked me about it was that it was very casually said, like very matter-of-factly, what prompted me to start asking around to a lot of different people, whoever I could meet in Anna, really, if they had also heard that.
What kind of perception did you have of the town before you made the first visit?
I really wasn't sure. I really didn't know. I honestly figured it was just it's a normal small town. I don't know. I mean, it's in Southern Illinois. It didn't strike me in any particularly unique way other than I knew that it had a certain sundown town history, but there are many towns that have sundown histories. You know, for my first visit or two to Anna, I wasn't trying to work on a particular story at all. I didn't even know that this was going to end up to be a story. I wasn't assuming that, oh, let me go to Anna and get my story. It took a couple different visits for me to figure out whether there was a story there at all. You know, the more and more people that I spoke with in Anna had acknowledged that they had, you know, known about ANNA. So it wasn't just the first person, you know, telling me ANNA at the bar, the restaurant that night. It was the fact that over and over again, people knew but didn't know what exactly happened.
We're talking with Logan Jaffe. She's a reporter for ProPublica. She wrote about the town of Anna, Illinois in a recent story and taking a look back at its history as what was known as a sundown town and where it is today. And Logan, I think it's interesting you mentioned that Anna is not necessarily that much different from a lot of other communities. Racism is prevalent north, south, in between. But this is one of those locations that does have an especially notorious past. You get into some of that, how a black man was lynched for a crime that I believe was committed in or around the town at one point.
Correct. Yeah. We're talking about an incident that happened in 1909 in Cairo, you know, about 35 miles south of Anna at the state's southernmost tip. In 1909, a white woman who was from Anna, a young white woman, her name was also coincidentally Anna, was found murdered in an alley. And a couple days later, a black man named William James was lynched in the middle of Cairo's commercial district. And this was an event that was attended by the newspaper at the time, the Cairo Bulletin, estimated thousands of people came out to take part in this and to be present for it.
It seems to me that when incidents like this happen, where a black man assumed guilty of a violent crime, but I guess we don't know because he did not go to trial, that incident resonates for decades. It makes maybe some people who harbor racist feelings feel a bit more vindicated, like, look what this person did. I'm right to feel this way. Do you think that's what happened in Anna?
Let me bring in the perspective of the local newspaper in Anna at the time. It's difficult to say exactly how people in Anna felt or if they felt vindicated at the time of the lynching. But actually, if you're looking at it through the perspective of the newspaper, the headline a few days after the lynching in Cairo said, "Well done, Cairo." So I guess that is a very explicit endorsement of those actions. And in oral histories that I've read from people in Union County who remember the lynching and what happened in Anna after that, there's a story that one man tells. He remembers the night after the lynching when a smaller mob of white Anna men went to a nearby quarry in Anna that employed a number of black people. And the workers, I am quoting the newspaper here, fled to the woods and they hadn't been seen for days. And in the oral history interview, the person says, you know, all of the black people were ran out of town after the Anna Pelley incident and the lynching in Cairo.
Well, word travels fast in a small town, so I'm sure your arrival and you're starting to talk to people that probably got around a bit. What did you hear from people, those that you were talking to? Were they open to discussing the town's past and what's going on now, or were they a little more tight-lipped about it?
Well, it's interesting because my first couple trips there, I was honestly just trying to get to know the town as a whole. When I would bring up and try to ask people and assess, okay, how extensive is this ANNA thing? Is it really a thing, or was the ANNA repeated to me at the bar, was that a fluke? I really was trying to get information about what happened. I met a lot of people who were just as interested in finding out about the story of ANNA as I was. You know, many people said, tell us what you find, because we don't know.
You did find some evidence that things have improved, at least to some level, in the town of Anna through the years, a little bit more of an open community.
Yeah. So in 2016, a woman named Easter Smith, who's a Black woman, moved to Anna with her 6 children. And they had reservations about moving there because they had heard about ANNA, but Easter was really willing to give it a shot. She wanted a safe place to raise her kids and to have a family. When I spoke to her, she said, honestly, I wish that I had moved to Anna sooner. She says that the community has very much supported her. And there's been incidents that have really bothered and upset the family, and kind of these casual everyday comments and interactions. You know, there, she told me a story about how a couple years ago, a couple students at the high school in Anna made a fake Instagram account and would anonymously, you know, roast classmates and post their pictures. And one of the comments about one of her children, it was the eldest son, you know, said something like, you know, you're Anna's Jackie Robinson, calling him the N-word. He is a very talented athlete. That's not something to be taken lightly. It's not something that the family has taken lightly. But Easter said that she was very encouraged that a lot of white parents spoke up about it and told the administrators how upset that they were about that post and that was not okay. And the fact that the school administration disciplined those students that were involved, it tells you something. It's complicated. I think how much or how little a community changes. And what I was hoping to do and what I was focusing on was trying to just hear from as many different people you know, I talk in the piece, which is written in the first person, and I acknowledge my perspective as an outsider. And I'm, you know, I write in the piece, I'm not claiming to know the full story of Anna, but it's interesting because I've gotten a couple of responses from people who have said, only because you're an outsider have you been able to actually ask the questions that you did. And that it'd be more difficult if somebody were an insider to do that story.
I thought it was interesting, too. You spoke with the mayor of Anna. I quoted him. Steve Hartline is his name.
Yeah.
And he mentioned, I'm going to read what he had to say here. It's a shame that wording is even out there when it comes to Anna. He calls it really sad and says, I'm just sorry we have to talk about that. That is not the Anna I know. I'm assuming there's a lot of people who feel that way as well, that the past is the past. Let's leave it there. Your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, I hear that. I mean, that saying or that belief and that mindset existed 150 years ago as well. Why do we talk about that? Why do we need to bring it up? When I would try to find information and try to pinpoint the story and do research in Anna and in Union County, there was no mention about ANNA. There was barely a mention of Anna's racial history in any of the local history books that I had read in the historical society. So it kind of goes back to this knowing and not knowing. And the question that I keep thinking of and you know, keep coming back to is, for people who believe that we are over the past, how do we know that if we are over the past if we don't know what specifically happened? How can we say for sure that this isn't something worth talking about because we've moved beyond that, if we don't entirely embrace and understand what we are moving beyond?
So what do you want people to take away from this story?
You know, in my mind, I had an image of somebody like Easter Smith, who, before she decided to move to Anna, was Googling and trying to find information about what exactly happened. Like, why is this myth here? And she couldn't really find information about what happened, about a documented history of what happened to give Anna that reputation. And part of me in my head was writing it for future Easters, not with the motivation in any way to discourage, because there is truth and there are facts behind myths. It could be the scenario that if you're able to put facts and truth and knowledge behind a myth and behind a narrative and behind a reputation, maybe you don't need AN and AA anymore. Maybe people stop saying it. I don't know. I don't know what all of the fallout and the aftermath and the future of Anna will be. I feel like it's not my place. But, you know, Anna is unique and also both not unique in a lot of ways. And I want to be clear that there are sundown towns all over the state. They're not just in Southern Illinois. They're all over the country. You know, in fact, in Dr. Lowen's book, Sundown Towns, I think he writes or suggests that the state of Oregon was an entire sundown state at one point. There are ways and different methods that a town has become sundown at various points in time. Some of them are more violent. Some of them are more public than others. You know, there are towns in the northern part of the state and Chicago suburbs where I bet if you were to look in the land deeds and the housing deeds, there would be clauses that say only Caucasians are allowed to live here. So there are various methods, and they're all to the same effect, which is to keep a place intentionally white. And that's something that people are still doing in some ways. Like, this is not a phenomenon of the past, but it looks different and it's pervasive throughout our entire country.
Logan Jaffe is a reporter with ProPublica. Last year, she wrote about the town of Anna in southern Illinois. It's a former sundown town. A link to that story is at our website at statewideshow.com. How much have things changed in towns like Anna? That might be difficult to answer, but safe to say many were surprised to see protests for racial justice showing up in communities in Illinois, large and small. We'll discuss that and more still to come here on Statewide. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A lot of dentists have reopened for routine procedures, but some who work in those offices are concerned about the risks of COVID-19. We'll have that story still ahead. We just heard about the notorious past of what some call sundown towns, but in the past several days, something rather remarkable happened in many of those same communities. Protests for racial justice took place. Molly Parker is a reporter for the Southern Illinois newspaper. She wrote about some of those events, and she joins me now. And Molly, in your area, you have Carbondale. That's a college town. It's not surprising to see a protest there, but you pointed out in your article that it went well beyond just that city.
Yeah, what we're seeing that is, you know, according to longtime observers here, significant makes this moment different in our region. And I think nationally as well, we're seeing the same thing, is that these protests, rallies, demonstrations, you know, whatever you want to call them, and they're different for different people, are taking place in our small rural communities across Southern Illinois that don't typically host rallies like this, even though Carbondale is certainly no stranger to protests and demonstrations. You know, I think I noted in my story, dating back to sort of Vietnam, civil rights era, Carbondale made a big mark in joining those national movements. But a lot of people in our small towns are telling me, I don't, you know, the 56-year-old people, that they don't remember ever seeing demonstrations like this in their hometown.
And these are smaller towns, as you mentioned. We're not talking protests the size of what happened in Chicago or St. Louis, but still some, I would think, impressive turnouts, the number of people who've joined in.
Oh, certainly. In Anna, you mentioned you just had a report on Anna in Union County at near the bottom tip of the state. And I want to say they estimated roughly 200. They've had a couple different demonstrations in DuCoin that brought out, you know, a collective more than 200 people. We've had them in Carterville, Herod, Benton, Illinois. That one also very surprisingly to people. Individuals across Southern Illinois are definitely taking note that it is unusual and, to many people, inspiring to see and mostly young folks taking a stand against racism in many of these rural towns.
The surprise there really is when you take a look back at the history of these communities, right?
That's right. I talked to a number of older African-Americans from Southern Illinois who talk about growing up being told that they could not go to Anna or Benton or places like that, that they wouldn't be welcome, that they wouldn't be safe, that they shouldn't go for their own protection. These are folks I've talked to who are in their 70s and 80s, but even talking to younger people of color my age, I'm heading up on 40 in my late 30s, that they remember this going on in the 90s, stories of people being discriminated against in restaurants or comments made to them. Many of these towns where these demonstrations are taking place, the population is overwhelmingly white, you know, upwards of 95% in some situations in some of the towns. And so a lot of that dates back to this, as you mentioned, historical sundown town policies where by official policy, people of color, African-Americans in particular, weren't allowed into the town after dark. And of course, those policies are not official anymore, but many people have argued that the legacy of that has, you know, passed down from generation to generation of, hey, you know, it's not safe for you to be here and you may face discrimination. And so over time, people avoid these communities, especially if they haven't done anything to actively change their reputation. I think it's, you know, it's important to note it doesn't mean that everyone in Anna or everyone in Benton espouses racist views by any means. And even when you read the history on some downtowns, that wasn't the case. It was that there were controlling factions, however, that did enforce those policies. And that even now, when we've removed ourselves from official policies, that people feel like they face more discrimination in some of these communities than they might in others. And so have been avoiding them. Although we are seeing diversification of some of these small towns, Anna in particular, as you know, Logan covered, not overwhelming diversity, but some of that beginning to change. And again, people saying that these types of protests at least signal the willingness of young people to really want to change those images.
We're talking with Molly Parker. She's a reporter for the Southern Illinoisan. You talked about the overwhelming makeup of white individuals in these communities, the population there. We did see a lot of white faces, though, out in those protests. This was not necessarily predominantly black-led protests. There were white people who were out there marching, and not only that, in some cases, organizing.
I would say that the crowd, that the vast majority of these protests were overwhelmingly white. In some cases, organized by young white people, in some cases, organized by young people of color, or in the best of worlds, both friends that have organized these protests together. But certainly in the ones I attended in Anna, in Benton, et cetera, the vast majority of people out demonstrating were white people and local people. You know, we've had rumors that, oh, these are people being bused in from Chicago. We've heard that. At all of the rallies that I've covered and that my colleagues have covered, they have been organized by local individuals who live in these communities or in those counties who wanted to take a stand.
The reaction to the rallies and the protests, what was that? And I know you wrote about one specifically, I believe, in Benton, where there were some tense moments you felt, I could tell in the article you mentioned that.
Yeah, in Anna and Benton both, there were people who were who were not supportive of the rallies. And Anna, there were some tense moments as well. And one of the things that you would hear the most was when they were chanting Black Lives Matter, there was a callback of All Lives Matter. And as that's been well explained, that the demonstrators would say, we know that, but until Black Lives Matter, all lives can't matter. So you would hear some of that. There were a few tense moments. And then just a lot of people out standing around watching, more like curious crowd watchers. I noticed that as well. And in Benton, the mood was a little more tense. Again, I want to be clear, the vast majority of the town was supportive. There were lots of people going by the square where it was held and honking, you know, shouting support, et cetera. But there were quite a few cars, more than you would like to see in this era, going by and flipping the bird, yelling, you know, negative things. I heard the N-word drop on the square by a couple guys that were singing a song and intentionally focusing on that word. So, yeah, there were tense moments. There was still clearly pushback by some members of the community to the message that the folks were trying to send.
And Molly, before I let you go, you put this into some perspective. I know we like to look at this and think, wow, this is a real step forward for race relations in different parts of the state, especially in some of these smaller communities. At the same time, are we reading too much into it?
I think both are true. You know, again, I spoke to a lot of people, including a lot of the African-American leaders of Southern Illinois who've been here a long time, and they certainly told me they found it encouraging, shocking, surprising, you know, heartwarming. These are some of the words I heard, to see people having protests in these communities, that it did send a message. At the same time, they most certainly cautioned that, you know, coming out with a sign, especially, you know, for white people who have been in control of the power structure of these towns generationally, that it's not enough to just come out with a sign. It's not enough to just have a Black Lives Matter, you know, filter on your Facebook page. Like, you have to also do the hard work, and that includes making sure that people are included in civic life and educational success in hiring and all of those things that, you know, come later. They're like, so yes, it's important to send that message, is what I was told, but that it doesn't stop there.
Molly Parker is a reporter for the Southern Illinois newspaper. She wrote about some of the recent protests for racial justice in Southern Illinois. Molly, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Sean.
In the small western Illinois town of Macomb, protests have been taking place several days a week. They began with one woman holding a Black Lives Matter sign, and they've grown to include more than 100 demonstrators. Rich Egger has that story.
Her name is Kaylee Shelton. She says not only are more and more people showing up, but more drivers are honking their horns in support as they pass the protest along the north edge of Chandler Park. And Shelton says businesses and individuals have donated water, snacks, and sunscreen. She's amazed by the response.
I never thought that it would have been this big or this long. You know, I just expected coming out that one day, and it's definitely overwhelming.
Shelton says she will keep coming out as long as others are willing to join her. She says Mayor Mike Inman is one of the people to join in.
I told him that he had to stand out here and hold a sign or he couldn't stay. So
she says that worked. The mayor held a sign while he was out there. Other community leaders have also participated, including Western Illinois University Interim President Martin Abraham and Police Chief Kurt Barker. Several uniformed police officers have also been on hand, not to curtail the protest, but rather to participate in them. Deputy Chief Dave Burnham says the department allows officers to demonstrate on their own time if they so choose.
If we're out here in plain clothes, you don't necessarily know they're a police officer. So we want to be out here in uniform to support our community, everyone in our community, and that's what we feel that we're doing.
Some of the most active protesters say these demonstrations are just a start. Celeste Townsend of Macomb says she's working to get a permit from the city to hold a silent march as part of a global event on July 7th.
And we're all going to walk together at the same time at noon in our respective areas, just to show solidarity and we're all together.
Townsend also says she would like Macomb to create a community review board with a diverse group of members. She says this would help those who encounter a problem with a legal proceeding.
I think in Macomb, there needs to be more of a reflection on the city level of the demographic and the community that's here.
Townsend says change can happen if people vote and if young people get involved in the struggle. Separate from those ideas, demonstrator Maya Lee says she's working with others to develop an action plan.
So our plan is to, you know, generate that, create a lot of research and find out what's going on with systemic racism in the Macomb area. And then once we have a more developed action plan, we're planning to present that to city officials and the police department as well.
Lee says the support from community leaders at the demonstrations has been great, but she's looking for action from them as well. Rich Ugger reporting.
Support for Statewide comes from AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. Nearly all states now are allowing dentist offices to reopen, no longer limiting visits to just emergencies. Detailed guidelines spell out steps for protecting staff and patients from COVID-19. But as Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman reports, some dental workers are still worried.
Even without a global pandemic, dentistry is inherently riskier than many other medical professions. That's because dentists and hygienists spend a lot of time inches away from wide open mouths. And procedures are known to generate aerosols, tiny droplets that can linger in the air and carry viruses. Given the risks, dentists are being advised to take numerous precautions, like wearing N95 masks and other protective gear. But back in March, dentists were asked to donate that gear to the front lines.
And they did, and now they're having trouble getting it back.
That's Jeannie Bosecker, president of Illinois' Dental Hygienists Association. Like others, she's taking steps to reduce aerosols, scraping teeth by hand instead of using the ultrasonic machines that spray air and water. Bosecker says her office struggled to get N95 masks when they first reopened. And in that case, CDC guidance says a surgical mask and a face shield can be used instead. She felt comfortable with that. But not all hygienists do, especially if they're at higher risk of complications from COVID-19.
I have a friend who has asthma, and her dentist, you know, isn't providing the N95 mask.
Some association members also say dentists are not providing enough protective gear or are asking hygienists to not change masks and gowns between patients. That's a violation of state and federal guidelines. Bosecker brought these concerns to the state's Dental Society.
And they kind of acted like, oh, well, you know, none of our members would ask our staff to work without appropriate PPE. They're in denial that it's happening.
I'm definitely not in denial that there could be situations where there are dentists that do not have the appropriate PPE and wanting to open.
Central Illinois dentist Stacy Van Skoik is vice president of the Dental Society. She says the dentists she knows who aren't able to get the right gear are waiting to reopen. And she says dentists are trying to minimize risks. They're screening for COVID-19 symptoms, spacing out appointments, and offering early time slots to patients in high-risk categories to minimize their exposure to aerosols. And Pernina Kumar of Ohio State University's Dental School points out there's no hard evidence that coronavirus is showing up in dental aerosols from patients who are not showing symptoms.
But that evidence is not available because nobody has looked for it. So absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Given the uncertainty, Kumar says dentists have to be careful and use their best judgment.
There's no ubiquitous, there's no universal one size fits all that can help.
Even the CDC has said it's too early to know for sure whether standard precautions adequately protect dental workers. That's what has some hygienists worried, like Alex in the North Chicago suburbs. She's back at work but doesn't think her office has enough air filtration units for the size of the space. We're using only her middle name because she worries speaking out could cost her her job.
I was told that I need to leave my fears at the door and carry on and act as if everything's fine. A lot of us don't feel safe going back.
Van Skoik of the Illinois Dental Society says workers with concerns should keep talking them through with employers. As for patients wondering what to do, she says a lot will depend on a person's dental health needs, their individual risk factors, and their comfort level.
If you do not feel comfortable going into any, you know, a medical office, a dental office, a hospital, then yes, I would say the recommendation is to not go in.
She says dentists and all healthcare providers want to help patients feel safe so that no one puts off care they really need. I'm Christine Herman, Side Effects Public Media.
Remember, you can find all of our episodes at statewideshow.com. Be sure to check that out, and you can also get our podcast each week through the NPR One app. Well, up next, have you wondered what it's like to be tested for COVID-19? We'll find out. That's ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. With the focus on policing, what about school resource officers? Some school districts are reconsidering that approach. We'll have the story. That's on the way. The idea of having the state of Illinois licensed police officers is gaining traction. Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker says he's looking hard at the concept. He suggests it could be a way to have an independent board investigate an officer's misconduct.
It's a way to take it into an independent realm and away from a specific local police department and have perhaps a more independent body look at the problems that a police officer has brought to their job.
The Attorney General Kwame Raoul and Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot also support licensing police officers. Lightfoot says it could help stop an officer with misconduct complaints against them from moving to other jobs within the state to escape their record. Well, this week, the governor signed the state budget that lawmakers passed last month. Sam Dunklaw has more on that.
During the next fiscal year, which starts July 1st, Illinois will spend nearly $43 billion on state operations, services, and employees. Pritzker did away with the usual signing ceremony over COVID-19 concerns. Critics have called the spending plan precarious since it's counting on money that hasn't materialized yet, at least $5 billion in special Federal Reserve loans. Lawmakers passed a separate law allowing the state to apply for that money, but how much it will end up with remains uncertain. Still, Pritzker and Democratic state lawmakers say it will keep, quote, critical funding for state agencies going and put the state in a good position to recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Sam Dunklaw.
Next, the Illinois Department of Public Health has so far collected more than 1 million COVID-19 tests from sites across the state. Brian Moline spoke with reporter Lee Gaines about what it was like to get tested at a drive-through COVID-19 site in Champaign. He started by asking her why she chose to get tested for the illness.
Well, I want to be clear that I don't have any symptoms of the virus. I decided to get tested, though, because I covered a protest in Champaign regarding police brutality. And it was the first time that I had actually been out in the field reporting, interacting with people face-to-face since early March. And the administrator for the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District told everyone who attended one of these protests that it would be a good idea for them to get tested for the virus about 5 to 7 days after they went. So I attended the protest on a Monday, and then this past Sunday, I went to Champaign's drive-through testing site to get my test done.
Where is the testing site in Champaign that you went to, and what was it like?
So the testing site is at the Marketplace Mall in Champaign, and it was pretty empty, to be honest with you. It's kind of this big parking lot behind the Field and Stream and the Dick's Sporting Goods store, and there's a bunch of orange cones set up for your car to drive through, and then you're greeted by someone. Everyone's wearing a mask. It's very clear that the people staffing the site are National Guard. They're in their camouflage fatigues. And, you know, we were asked questions like, do you have any symptoms? Were you exposed to anyone who had the virus? My answer to both of those questions was no. And then they proceeded to let us through. We reached a tent area, stopped the car. We had to keep our windows rolled up, which was kind of uncomfortable just because it was such a hot day on Sunday that the car heated up pretty quickly and we also had to turn the car off. But aside from that, it was pretty painless. So what I was surprised about, though, was that the test was self-administered. So what they did was they had us roll down our windows a crack after taking our information, like our cell phone number, address, looking at our IDs, and they passed through these long Q-tips, essentially, and little vials full of liquid. And so they directed us to put the Q-tip in each of our nostrils about an inch. They really said, you know, don't go further than that because you're going to hurt yourself. And then to keep them in our nose in each one of our nostrils for about 15 seconds. And after that, we put the Q-tip in this little vial, screwed the top on the vial, and handed it through the window to the National Guard's folks that were manning the testing site that day.
And it's a free service, is that correct?
It is free. I didn't have to pay for it at all. I also didn't have to present my health insurance card. It was totally free. The only thing they really needed from me was my ID, and they also needed my phone number because that's how they share the results. They call you.
And how soon did you get those results?
So they told me that it would take between 4 to 7 days, but it actually only took about 24 hours. So the following day, which was a Monday, that afternoon, I missed a call from an 888 number, and I called them back, and it was the state of Illinois Department of Public Health, and they gave me my test results, which were negative.
That's reporter Lee Gaines talking about what it's like to get tested for COVID-19. You can find locations and hours of operations for testing sites online at the website idph.illinois.gov/testing. Against the backdrop of unrest, protests, and COVID-19, students are still marking important milestones like graduation from high school and college. The coronavirus forced some changes to graduation ceremonies. And from member station WBEZ, Kate McGee tells us that especially stings for those who are the first in their families to earn a college degree.
When Olivia Cruz found out her graduation from the University of Illinois at Chicago would be virtual, she almost cried. Then she felt guilty.
At that point, I didn't want to be selfish or, I'm so sad because graduation is not happening when there's thousands of people dying in the world because of COVID-19. And there is, so much uncertainty.
Cruz immigrated to the United States from Mexico in her early 20s. She's the first in her family to earn a college degree. Her father graduated from high school, and her mother did not go past elementary school. For many first-generation college students, graduation is not just the culmination of years of term papers and studying. It's a tangible symbol of a generation of sacrifices families made by immigrating to the United States, working multiple jobs, or other ways parents provided opportunities they didn't have themselves. Cruz, who is now 28, looked at her graduation ceremony as a way to celebrate her mom and dad.
It was like a gift for me to them, look, like, you did good. you did good parenting. You didn't have to go to college to know how to raise me. You did everything you could, and this is the result of it.
Another UIC graduate, Edith Mendez, felt similarly. Her father stopped going to school after elementary school. Her mother actually earned a bachelor's degree in Mexico, but couldn't use it in the United States. Instead, she stayed home and raised Edith and her sisters. Edith wanted her younger sisters to see her use her degree to become independent.
That's something, that no one in my family has done, completely, and something that I actually get to practice. Like, I don't have to be a stay-at-home mom or not get to, work in the field that I was so passionate about and that I worked hard to study for.
She already has a job offer to be an art teacher in the fall. Student LaTanja Dotson is also the first in her family to earn a bachelor's in marketing psychology from DePaul University at 43 years old. She wanted to set a good example for her 12-year-old son.
My son, he has childhood apraxia. It's a speech disorder. So I knew that with school, with him, it would be challenging. I knew that I had to encourage him. He was looking up to me. I was his role model. So I had to go get my college education.
Dotson says she was devastated that she too won't get that in-person graduation, but is trying to find a silver lining. She can invite whoever she wants to a virtual commencement.
Now all my friends and family can still have an opportunity to witness my accomplishment, and that's really warming to my heart.
Then George Floyd was killed after a police officer kneeled on his neck for almost 9 minutes while detaining him. Dotson, who is Black, says it's become even harder to celebrate while she's feeling and witnessing so much pain.
I had a conversation with my husband about it, and he's like, be happy about this. Be happy about all the accolades that you receive. You know, even though there's pain, we still have to find joy in it. And this is the joy that you're going to give us and our family right now. But the pain will still be there.
Student Olivia Cruz is seeing her graduation as a call to action. She got her degree in public health and wants to improve health disparities in low-income communities. She says the national conversation about racism and inequality is highlighting how important that career choice is.
I think these are perfect times to come out and help others, and what a best moment to graduate and start caring for social issues.
Cruz says now that she has a college degree, she recognizes she has more privilege than others in her Latinx community. She says especially now, she feels it's time to use that privilege to give back.
Kate McGee with that report. School districts across the country are wondering if they should get rid of school resource officers. Peter Medlin has more on the police-free schools movement and the role of SROs in their own words.
Does having more officers in a school automatically mean more safety? More and more schools are questioning that premise after the protests sparked from the killing of George Floyd. School-based policing is one of the fastest-growing sectors of law enforcement. And when mass shootings like in Parkland, Florida, shine a light on school safety, districts often react by adding officers. Judith Brown-Dianis is the executive director of Advancement Project, a national racial justice organization. Brown-Dianis says police aren't the solution to school shootings.
What schools need to be thinking about is how do we create environments where that young person doesn't bring a gun into school.
Studies show that students of color are disciplined at disproportionate rates in schools. An Advancement Project says police presence in schools exacerbates that disparity and fuels a, quote, school-to-prison pipeline.
As long as we keep throwing police at the problem and siphoning off money, millions of dollars, to militarize our schools, it makes young people think, you don't trust me, you think I'm a criminal.
Brown-Dianis says that money should be spent on mental health services like counselors and school psychologists. Jamie Craven is the superintendent at DeKalb Public Schools. He says schools shouldn't have to choose between mental health services and officers. His district just added a third school resource officer, or SRO, this year.
The mental health providers are also working in a very preventative role. Our SROs are doing it, you know, from a different perspective. I would never say, you know, one is more important than the other.
He said their new officer was hired primarily to support staff at the middle and elementary levels.
It was more to help assist with parents and adults who were upset and showing up at the buildings.
Craven says DeKalb's SROs are there to do the obvious as well, like threat assessment and event security. Kip Heinley has been a school resource officer at the Triad School District for 15 years. He echoed Craven's statements about SROs being more than just officers.
We're mentors to these kids. Sometimes we deal with kids without fathers or mothers, or, you know, they're just having a bad day. So we're mentors, we're counselors.
He says his main goal is to make a difference and show that not all police officers are bad. For him, that means going to games and events to support students. Judith Brown-Dianis and Advancement Project don't think officers are qualified to function in that capacity.
Why does it have to be a police officer that builds a good relationship? Why can't it be a mental health professional? Why can't it just be the coach? Why can't it, you know, all of these other people?
Heinley says he works with school counselors every day, but bottom line, he says SROs need to be there to protect schools. And in an active shooter situation, he says every second counts.
When evil walks down your hall in a school building, who's going to stop the evil? You have to have police in there. But like I said, we go hand in hand with school psychologists and school social workers.
He says he only made one arrest at school last year.
As far as police work goes, I'm very fortunate. I don't do a whole lot of police work. It was a good school. I don't take many calls, but I keep busy.
That includes assisting with weekend calls that may deal with students or former students. Heinle supports SROs having more training and recently worked with the state to develop a training program for officers. He says it's a 40-hour regimen that includes trauma-enforced care and crisis intervention. Participants also need to be certified juvenile officers. But if officers have taken the national training program, he says they likely won't have to do Illinois' as well. That Illinois training program was supposed to go into effect in January 2021, but Heinle says it'll most likely be delayed due to COVID-19. Meanwhile, some districts are considering whether to remove SROs altogether. The Chicago Teachers Union is one of the latest calling for police-free schools. The Chicago SRO program was called highly problematic by an inspector general report in 2019 after it failed to make reforms. Changes have been implemented, but it's uncertain whether it'll be enough, or if Chicago will join the likes of Minneapolis and remove police officers from its schools. I'm Peter Medlin.
That wraps up this week's Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this show or our past shows, find them all at statewideshow.com, and our podcast is available through the NPR One app. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.